Okay, I want to pick up where we left off in the book of Ezekiel. We left off in Ezekiel chapter 41, and I think I was commenting when we started this chapter 40, and I was commenting how chapters 40 through 48, they're probably the most neglected portion of Scripture because it just gets into so much detail, and there's actually just thousands of different details that are brought across, and I think most people would just shy away from reading it. I think that this probably from chapters 40 to 48 in Ezekiel is probably the least read and one of the least understood. People will read genealogies before they think they get into this. In another class I'm teaching on Tuesday morning, I'm happening to be going through the portion of Exodus where we're really dealing with the tabernacle. So, and that's another portion of Scripture that's pretty well neglected because there's so much involved in terms of the dimensions and the materials and the furniture and the clothing, the priest clothing. It really, really gets involved. And so does these last nine chapters of Ezekiel. And we're dealing with the millennial temple. And this is going to be a temple that's going to come into play when Jesus Christ returns and sets up his millennial kingdom. And he's going to reign for 1,000 years. And this is basically the outline or the design of this temple that Ezekiel is given when Jesus Christ is ruling and reigning. And I think I had mentioned last week, it's very important that we understand something when we're going through this, is that when we're reading all about this temple, we're going to be reading about the fact that all of the animal sacrifices of the Old Testament are going to be reinstituted. And that's something that I think people just don't understand. That's why a lot of times when people read Ezekiel, they just don't understand that this is the millennial temple. This is a time when Jesus Christ is ruling and reigning. But I had shared this last week, and I'm just going to preface what we're reading tonight with this as well, because we really have to understand where God is coming from. For example, in Hebrews chapter 10, it says this: "For the law, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come and not the very form of things, can never, by the same sacrifices which they offer continually year by year, make perfect those who draw near." In other words, all these animal sacrifices never made a person right with God. All they did was cover over sins. They never took away sins. And he goes on to say in Hebrews chapter 10, it says, "Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered because the worshipers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have had consciousness of sins? But in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins year by year, for it is impossible." I'm going to repeat that. "For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Therefore, when he," Jesus Christ, "comes into the world, he says, 'Sacrifice, an offering you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sins you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, Behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me to do your will, O God.'" After saying the above, "Sacrifices and offerings and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sins you have not desired, nor have you taken pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law," then he said, "Behold, I have come to do your will." And he takes away the first in order to establish the second. "By this we will have been sanctified through the offerings of the body of Jesus Christ once and for all." Now, I want to emphasize that because Jesus Christ's death on that cross is atoning death on that cross. It takes away sins once and for all. So once we get that understood in our hearts and in our minds, then when we're going to be reading about this temple, we got to understand that all the animal sacrifices that are going to be reinstituted, they don't take away sins any more than the Old Testament sacrifices took away sins. But they all point back to the cross. And we went through chapter 40 of Ezekiel. We were dealing with all of the different gates and all the different dimensions. As a matter of fact, if you look at that diagram there, they had the east gate, they had the south gate, they had the north gate, and then there was no gate at the west, at the rear end of this whole entire complex here. But I was commenting about all these different gates. They had the gates that went into the outer court, and then they had the gates that go into the inner court. And now tonight we're going to be actually talking about the temple itself, going into the temple. But when Ezekiel said that these pillars are approximately 60 cubits or about 90 feet tall, the guardhouse itself is that high. It's over 90 feet high. That really says a lot. And it's got windows on it, pointing to the fact that now we can see clearly as far as Jesus Christ having, you know, come back to earth. I mean, it was Paul talked about how we, at this particular time in our Christian walk, it's almost as though we look through a very dark glass. He says that this is the way we see spiritual things at this point, but when Jesus Christ comes back and sets up his kingdom, we're going to see clearly. That's why they have those windows on, in that guardhouse. And also, just briefly, when you go into the guardhouse, they've got Levites on both sides in that guardhouse, and they inspect the animals that go into that, basically into the courtyard, and basically are going to be sacrificed to the Lord. Well, they inspect these animals, and the Bible has a lot to say about gatekeepers. And in a sense, I think every parent needs to be a gatekeeper. What do I mean by that? Well, you know, as Christians, I really think that we need to be gatekeepers of our house in this respect. We really have to, I think, inspect what comes into our house and turn away. That's what's going to be detrimental to our household, to our children, especially in regards to stuff like, for example, movies that could be undermine a person's faith, or anything that comes in and dealing with witchcraft or the occult or Ouija boards or tarot cards, or, you know, all of these type of things. The parents need to be the gatekeeper and say, that's not coming into this house, all right? Any kind of pornography, that's not coming into the house. Any type of false teaching, false doctrine, that doesn't come into this house. See, we are gatekeepers even today. But that's why these gates were so, I think, prominent and so important, because it's really emphasizing the fact that nothing is going to be given to the Lord that does not pass inspection, all right? Now, I know I've been kind of beating this to death, but I want to go through this chapter 41, and believe me, it's very tough reading. I feel like sometimes, you know, when I teach the Bible, sometimes you can go through a book, go through a chapter, go through, you know, a verse, and it's kind of like wading ankle deep. And then sometimes you're up to your knees, and then sometimes up to your waist, and then sometimes up to your chest, sometimes up to your neck. And now what I've been teaching, what I'm going to be teaching in this book of Ezekiel, I feel like I'm way out in the ocean, way out in the ocean. And I got miles of water beneath me, and there's miles of water around me. That's how I think out of my element I feel when I'm going through this. But what I want to do when I get into this chapter 41, it's going to be describing the temple itself. All right, when we talked about last week, you go through these outer gates, and then you go through the inner gates, and now you get into the inner court, and now it's talking about going into the temple itself, where Jesus Christ is going to be residing during his 1,000-year reign. But before I start this chapter 41, I just want to back up a few verses, and in this chapter 40, as it leads into this chapter 41, because it says here in that verse 47, let's start with that, verse 47 of chapter 40 of Ezekiel, it says, he measured the court, a perfect square, 100 cubits long and 100 cubits wide, and the altar was in front of the temple. Now, the court that he's mentioning here, he's talking about this court here, the inner court. The inner court he's talking about, this outer court was much, much larger. But now he's going into the inner court, and this inner court he's talking about, it measures 100 cubits long and 100 cubits wide. In other words, it's square. Right there, that's the court he's talking about. And then he says this in this verse 48, then he brought me to the porch of the temple and measured each side pillar of the porch, 5 cubits on each side, and the width of the gate was 3 cubits on each side. So in other words, I don't know if you can make out this diagram here, but now this is the outer court over here, but now he's going into the temple itself, or the sanctuary itself, all right? And he's talking about the porch here. He says, he brought me to the porch of the temple. This is the porch right there. And he says, then he brought me to the porch of the temple and measured each side pillar. Now, the side pillar he's talking about is right there. And these pillars are huge, because he says there are 5 cubits on each side, and the width of the gate was 3 cubits on each side. So he's talking about these pillars here. As you go into the temple, they're 5 cubits wide, and then they're 60 cubits high, approximately. So these are like 90 feet high, but they're also 5 cubits wide, which would be about 7.5 feet or so wide. So they're just massive pillars when you're going into the temple itself. And then he says here, And the width of the gate was 3 cubits on each side. So he's talking about here, the gate, when you go into it, you enter into it, it opens up. So there's 3 cubits on each side of the gate when you're going into the porch. And then he says this, the length of the porch was 20 cubits. This is the porch right here. It's 20 cubits. I keep losing my place. The length of the porch was 20 cubits and the width of it was 11 cubits. So it's 11 cubits wide and it's 20 cubits long. That's just the porch, just entering into the temple. And it says, and at the stairway by which it is ascended were columns belonging to the side pillars, one on each side. And it's talking about ascending when he goes up the stairs there. And keep in mind, there's 8 steps when you get into the temple. And if you remember when I was talking about last week, that this is speculative on my part, but I do believe that the fact that it mentions 8 steps entering into the temple, it could refer to what Peter referred to in 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 5 through 7. He talks about, you know, these different 8 steps where we to be diligent, and then in our diligence add moral excellence, and then in our moral excellence add knowledge, and then add self-control and perseverance and godliness and brotherly love and kindness, or excuse me, brotherly kindness and then love. So that's just speculative. A lot of this is just speculative on my part. But then you go into this temple here, and it says here, beginning with this verse 1 of 41 of chapter 41 of Ezekiel, it says, then he brought me into the nave. Now the nave, that's the sanctuary. You see it right there? All right, he goes right into the sanctuary, and he says, he brought me into the nave and measured the side pillars 6 cubits wide on each side was the width of the side pillars. Now, they had these outer pillars here going into it, and then you go into the temple itself or the sanctuary, and they got side pillars when you go into there. And the pillars, I think, are very significant because there's so many pillars in this whole superstructure. And you could tell me what pillars stand for in the Bible.
Strength.
What's that?
Strength.
Yeah, strength or beauty or support. But remember in the Old Testament, there was a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of cloud by night showing God's presence. But also, just keep this in mind, because pillars also refer to people in the church, are basically pillars of the church. I mean, the apostles were referred to as pillars of the church. And not only that, we were read in the Revelations where Jesus talked about some overcomers, that he would make them pillars in the house of his God. So I think that's probably why there's so many pillars that are mentioned in this whole superstructure, because it's really pointing to something spiritual. You could take it literally because that's exactly what it is, but these pillars have a powerful spiritual significance, all pointing to the, you know, the presence of God and people who are pillars within the church. I don't care whether they're the pastors or the ministers or their teachers or their prophets or their apostles or their evangelists. These are all pillars of the church. Then he says this in verse 2 of chapter 41 of Ezekiel. It says, the width of the entrance was 10 cubits and the sides of the entrance were 5 cubits on each side. And he measured the length of the nave 40 cubits and the width 20 cubits. Now, as you can see right here, it's 40 cubits in that inner sanctuary. This is would be referred to as the holy place. The holy place. It's 20 cubits wide and 40 cubits long when you get into the sanctuary here. And then he says in verse 3, then he went inside and measured each side pillar of the doorway 2 cubits and the doorway 6 cubits high and the width of the doorway 7 cubits. So when he goes in there, he measures these particular pillars. And he says in verse 4, he says, he measures its length 20 cubits and its width 20 cubits before the nave. And he said to me, this is the most holy place. So now he goes in here. He goes into the holy place. There's still a couple more pillars when he goes in here to the holy place. That's the holy of holies that he's going into there. It's the most holy place that he's talking about in this temple. That's where the presence of God is going to dwell, right there. And he says in this verse 5, excuse me, then he measured the wall of the temple 6 cubits and the width of the side chambers 4 cubits all around about the house on every side. Now he's talking about this wall here, the wall of the sanctuary. This thing is just massive. I mean, it says here, he measured the wall of the temple 6 cubits. Now, 6 cubits, that'd be about 9 foot thick wall. I mean, that is just really thick, isn't it? And then he says, and the width of the side chambers, 4 cubits, and the all around the house on every side. So this is what you've got here, is this wall. Now, what's a wall point to? Again, I think what we're really dealing with here is the wall of separation, in the sense that, you know what, God is a holy God, and there's no getting into the presence of God on our own merits or our own ingenuity or through any kind of false religion or cult or any kind of false beliefs. People have all kinds of spiritual beliefs today, but they're not going to get into the presence of God, because this is what this wall is indicating, that there's only one way in the presence of God, and that's through the door. Jesus Christ is the door. He said that He is the door. He is the way. He is the gate. He says in this verse 6 of chapter 41, it says, the side chambers in the three stories, one above another, and 30 in each story, and the side chambers extended to the wall, which stood on their inward side all around, and that they might be fastened and not be fastened into the wall of the temple itself. The side chambers surrounding the temple were wider at each successive story, because the structure surrounding the temple went upward by stages on all sides of the temple. Therefore, the width of the temple increased as it went higher, and thus one went up from the lowest story to the highest by way of the second story. I saw also that the house had a raised platform all around. The foundation of the side chambers were a full rod of 6 long cubits in height. The thickness of the outer wall of the side chambers was 5 cubits, but the free space between the side chambers belonged to the temple. And the outer chambers were 20 cubits in width all around the temple on every side. Now, let me just explain this to you the best I can, because years ago, I drew this temple that looked like this, because he's talking about this temple. When you go in there, it's got 3 stories above it. But the way that he is describing these different levels or these different stories on this temple is that they go outward. In other words, they expand as you go up. I mean, it's almost like an inverted pyramid, each story. Now, when I drew these pictures here, I was just racking my brain, trying to go through every dimension here, and I figured, well, this temple is looking like it's going out. But now, after I've done more research on it, I get this impression that this is how it looks on the inside. It's got these different stories that expand out, but then encasing this whole thing is the wall. In other words, it looks rectangular, but if you go in there, this is what it looks like. It looks like an almost an inverted pyramid. And then the way it's described here is this wall, the outer wall that I don't have right there, because, you know, it didn't dawn on me that it would look like it would look rectangular itself. But the way that it is constructed, I guess the way I'm reading it now, and with all the more research that I've done, it actually has this massive wall that goes up and around it. So it's almost encased. And these different chambers here, they don't connect to the wall. There's a separation between them. All right. So what you're looking at there that I drew years ago, that's what it looks like when you go inside. But it's actually encased in a rectangular wall is what it is. And I don't know, there might be some pictures of it somewhere around here that I've got, but this basically what the whole thing looks like. This here is just a picture of the outside of the temple itself, and they have these different chambers here. That would suggest to me that these are used as not only storage rooms, but also the priests are there. They may stay there as far as have quarters there, and you know, when Jesus Christ is ruling and reigning, no doubt there's going to be a multitude of Levites who are going to have all kinds of different jobs, and they probably will minister unto the Lord in rotation, maybe 1 month on and then maybe once every 12 months. It all depends upon how many Levites there are and how they break up the priesthood in terms of everybody's responsibility. But there's probably sleeping quarters there, and there's probably storerooms there as well. You know what verse I left off on? Because, man, I'll tell you, I feel like I'm in the ocean here. One more thing, too. And as far as that verse 8 goes, it says, and I saw also the house had a raised platform all around the foundation of the side chambers were a full rod, 6 long cubits in height. Now, I don't know if you can see it here, but this is, it's raised. It's raised on a platform right there. I put that whole temple on a concrete slab, basically, the way they have it showed there. But it's raised up in the sense that, you know, the foundation points to what spiritually? What's that? Yeah, but I think it was Paul who said it best in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. He said this. He says, for we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, God's building. In other words, this spiritually, we are God's temple. And he goes on to say this in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 10, it says, according to the grace of God, which was given to me like a wise master builder, I laid a foundation. I'm going to repeat that. I laid a foundation, and another is building on it. But each man must be careful how he builds on it. For no one can lay a foundation other than the one which has been laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if any man builds on a foundation with gold and silver and precious stones, wood, hay, and stubble, each man's work will become evident, for the day will show it, because it is to be revealed with fire, and the fire itself will test the quality of each man's work. If any man's work which he has built on remains, he will receive a reward. If any man's work is burned up, he will suffer loss. But he himself will be saved, yet as though through fire. In other words, Paul is saying this. There's only one foundation. That foundation is Jesus Christ. It's not Buddha. It's not Muhammad. It's not Confucius. It's not all of these Eastern mysticism beliefs. It's not all this stuff. The foundation is Jesus Christ. But, you know, we could be on the right foundation and then building with the wrong materials. Give me an example. All right, people can put their faith in Christ, and I've known people, for example, who their whole Christian doctrine is built on water baptism and the formula of baptism and how you have to be baptized in Jesus' name and not the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. To me, that's building a wood, hay, and stubble. But people can still be saved because they're on the right foundation. But if they're building with the wrong materials, then they're going to suffer a great loss, because everything we do for Christ is going to pass through the fire. Every Bible study I've ever taught, including this one tonight, as difficult as it is, it's going to go through the fire. I may just come out smelling like smoke and, you know, have nothing to show for it. But I'm trying to build with gold and silver and precious stones, right? But there are a number of people, and there have been throughout the church's ages, who put their faith in Jesus Christ, and then they come up with all this, their own pet peeve doctrines, and then they build with that. That's not the right way to build. But anyway, I didn't want to get off on a tangent here, but that foundation, that points to the fact that Jesus Christ is our foundation. That's what he's talking about in that verse 8. But now jump over to this verse 11 of chapter 41 of Ezekiel. It says this: the doorways of the side chambers towards the free space consisted of one door towards the north, another doorway towards the south, and the width of the free space was 5 cubits all around. Now he's talking about here, there's a free space here. I don't know if you guys can see this drawing here, but to see this, that's the space he's talking about. It goes all the way around the temple. And then he says this in that verse 12, the building that was in front of the separate area at the side towards the west was 70 cubits wide, and the wall of the building was 5 cubits thick all around, and its length was 90 cubits. Now, you know what he's talking about here? He's talking about a building that's at the back of the temple, the west side of the temple. And he gives the dimensions here. Now, I don't know if you can see it on my drawing there, but this is the building. It's at the back of the temple. I'm going to read it again. That verse 12, the building that was in the front of the separate area at the side towards the west was 70 cubits wide, and the wall of the building was 5 cubits thick all around, and its length was 90 cubits. Now, we're not told what this building is used for. It's a building that's in the back of the temple, right? It's backed in there. But let me just speculate here, because that's all. Like I said, I'm way out of my depth here, right? This is way over my pay grade, I'm telling you. I would really like to be able to take a few classes myself if I could find somebody who could really teach it. All I'm saying is this is my take on it. That building in the back, even though we're not given any clue as to what it would be used for, the Bible really talks about how when Jesus Christ is ruling and reigning on earth for 1,000 years, it says that the law is going to go forth from Zion. In other words, it's going to go forth from Jerusalem. It's going to go forth from Jesus Christ himself when he's ruling and reigning. And this is my impression, that even when Jesus Christ told his 12 apostles, he said that you're going to be judging the 12 tribes of Israel during this millennial period. Each particular tribe of Israel is going to have an apostle that's going to be their judge. In other words, if anybody has a dispute, if anybody has a question, if anybody needs some clarification about God's laws, they will go to one of the apostles, all right, because they're going to judge the 12 tribes. But I get this impression that this building in the back of the temple is probably a huge conference hall where Jesus Christ will meet with his apostles, and he will meet with the spiritual leaders, and he will discuss what it is that they need to know as far as the law going forth all throughout the world. Now, that's totally speculative, but if you read that verse 12 of chapter 41 of Ezekiel, it doesn't tell you anything what this building is for, right? Other than the dimensions, and it's behind a temple. And then he says in this verse 13 of chapter 41 of Ezekiel, it says, then he measured the temple 100 cubits long, and the separate area with the building and its walls were also 100 cubits long. Now, he's talking about here, the building itself is 100 cubits. Now, 100 cubits, if it's an 18-inch cubit, it's 150 feet long. All right. I know the tabernacle during the days of Moses, the entire court area, the linen wall that went all the way around the tabernacle, and it was upheld by 60 pillars, that was 150 feet long, and it was 75 feet wide. So this temple itself is as large as the court was during Moses' day. So the temple is pretty darn big. And then it says here in that verse 14, it says, also the width of the front of the temple and that of the separate areas along the east side totaled 100 cubits. So now he's talking about the length being 100 cubits, but then if you throw in the courtyard here, this is 100 cubits here. The temple itself is 100 cubits long, but let me read that verse 14. Also, the width of the front of the temple and that of the separate areas along the east side totaled 100 cubits. So he's talking about this right in here, this area here. He says in verse 15, he measured the length of the building along the front of the separate area behind it with a gallery on each side, 100 cubits. He also measured the inner nave and the porches of the court, the thresholds, the lattice windows, and the galleries all around about three stories opposite the threshold were paneled with wood all around and from the ground to the windows, but the windows were covered over the entrance to the inner house and on the outside and on all the walls around the inside and out by measurement. He's talking about this, the different chambers that they have there, but there's also some windows that it says that they're curtained over. There's just windows in this. Maybe it looks something like that there, the windows, but they're curtained over. Now, this is speculative on my part too, but here's what's kind of interesting to me about this, is that they have windows there, but I guess they've got shades or they got curtains on them. It's right where God dwells. It's right there, the holy place, the sanctuary, and the most holy place, or the Holy of Holies. Here's the thing I think that it's really suggesting is this. First of all, when you go into the Holy of Holies and you go into the sanctuary, they have doors there that are swinging doors, and it says you can go in and you can go out. So here's my take on it, because Jesus Christ said in the Gospel of John, chapter 8, he talked about him being the door. As a matter of fact, it was John. He said it in John chapter 10 as well. He said this. He says, truly, truly, I say to you that he who does not enter by the door into the fold of the sheep, he climbs up another way. He is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is a shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he puts forth all his own, he goes ahead of them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. A stranger they simply will not follow, but will flee from him because they do not know the voice of the stranger. This figure of speech Jesus spoke to them, but they did not understand what those things were which he had been saying to them. So Jesus said to them again, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. Now, here's the thing. When you go into these doors here, which suggested to me very strongly, especially when you got this temple with the windows at the top of it, it suggested this. When we go into the presence of God and we're all alone, guess what? Nobody else sees this. That's why there's the curtains. And let me just put it a different way. I don't know about you guys, but I always find it more difficult for me to pray when I'm in church and there's a lot of people around. All right, and you know, they're having the church service, and I don't care whether they're singing praises to God or whether the pastor's giving a sermon. Whatever it is, it's always more difficult for me to pray in a crowd Do you guys find that to be...
Yeah, because you're distracted by the people or the noises or...
And there's such distraction, right? So it's very hard to keep your focus. But I go to church almost every day where nobody's around. And I just go in, and there's nobody there. And it's so much easier for me to focus, all right? Because there's no distractions. And then when I pray to God, it's just natural. It just comes second nature to me. I always pray out loud, because it's like I'm talking to somebody, like I'm talking to you guys or talking to somebody else, right? Talking to somebody that you know, like he's just standing in front of you, because you know in your heart of hearts he's listening to you, right? But we're talking about going into this, into God's presence. And then this is something that's a communion between you and God, all right? This is something that's private. That's why it's the windows that are covered over. It's kind of like this is nobody else's. It can enter into this connection that we have with God, other than, you know, ourselves at that particular moment. But then once we stay in the presence of God, and once we touch God in our spirits and are touched by God by His Spirit, then when we go out, we are now in a position to minister to other people, right? But we have to make that a habit. Jesus Christ talked about Him being the door, and that we can go in and out and find pasture. In other words, we always have to sit in the presence of God all alone, all right? Just a one-on-one. That's why it's the curtains. That's why it's the windows of this temple that are suggesting that very strongly. And then once we sit in God's presence and are touched by Him, by His Spirit, and we touch Him and He touches us, now we're in a situation where we can go forth and you know, work for Him or proclaim His name, you know, minister to other people. Right, we need to do this on a daily basis. That's why I'm always asking people, how much time do you spend alone with God in prayer? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not putting a timetable on anybody's prayer life at all, because that's not the point at all. But it is something that we have to really take inventory when it comes to our relationship with God, because if we spend little or no time with God alone in prayer on a one-on-one on a daily basis, then there's something really radically wrong with our relationship with Him. There really is. If all we have is what we do on Sunday morning or go to church twice a year, Christmas and Easter, then there's no relationship there at all, right? So that's what we have to be cultivated there in the presence of God. And I think that that's what that's pointing to. But then He also says this. Talked about in that verse 16, the thresholds, the lattice windows, and the galleries around about their three stories opposite the threshold were paneled with wood all around and from the ground to the windows, but the windows were covered. And it's talking about they were paneled with wood. Well, in the tabernacle, the most holy things, like for example, the Ark of the Covenant and the altar of incense and the table of showbread, they were all made of acacia wood, but they were overlaid with gold. And the wood really points to Jesus Christ's humanity, right? Because time and time again in the Bible, the trees are symbolic of men. You know, or men are symbolized by trees. So it really points to the fact that Jesus Christ is fully man here. And it says in that verse 17, it talks about the windows were covered over the entrance and to the inner house on the outside and all the wall round inside and out by measurements. My measurement, it was carved with cherubim and palm trees, and the palm trees was between the cherub, and every cherub had two faces, a man's face towards the palm tree on one side, and a young lion's face towards the palm tree on the other side. They were carved on all the house all around. Now, here's what's interesting, too, is that when you get into this temple area, this inner sanctuary, all over the walls, they've got cherub, which was angels, and they have two faces. And one is the face of a man. What does it say here? In verse 18, it was carved cherubim with palm trees, and a palm tree and a cherub, and a cherub, and every cherub had two faces, a man's face towards the palm tree on one side, and a young lion's face towards the palm tree on the other side. So when you get in there, the whole wall, you know, has palm trees on it. But what do the palm trees point to, spiritually, symbolically? What are they pointing to? What's that?
Victory.
Yeah, why? The palm branches, right. Remember we read also, I think it's in Revelation chapter 7, where there are a multitude of people in heaven praising God with white robes on and palm branches in their hands. And they're singing praises to God. And one of the elders asked John, who are these? And John said, well, I don't know. And the elder said, these are the ones that come out of the great tribulation, and they've washed their robes in the blood of the Lamb. And they come from every tribe, every nation, every language, every tongue. And they got palm branches in their hands, showing that they were victorious over the Antichrist. Well, these palm trees are pointing to the fact that Jesus Christ was victorious over all the powers of darkness and all the temptations and everything that he went through. He was totally victorious. But it also says that around there is all these carvings of a cherub, which is an angel, but it has two faces. And one is the face of a lion, and the other is the face of a man. But when we went through the beginning of this book of Ezekiel, he saw these living creatures, and four of them were like cherubs or like angels, but they all had one head and four faces. The face of a man, the face of a lion, the face of an eagle, and the face of an ox. And then you go to the book of Revelation. John describes how these four living creatures, they only have one head, but they all have a different face. The face of a man, the face of an eagle, the face of a lion, the face of an ox. Well, the carvings on the walls here are not only full of palm trees, but they're also full of angels with two faces. And you wonder, well, how come they don't have four faces? Can anybody figure it out? Or just guess, because that's all I'm doing. I'm just guessing. Well, I would put it this way, all right? The eagle's missing, but the eagle pointed Jesus Christ's heavenly origin. But now that Jesus Christ is in the temple itself, there's no need for the eagle to be shown. But also, the ox is missing, and I think that that's kind of significant because the ox always pointed to Jesus Christ as a suffering servant. All right, he really brings this out in the book, Gospel of Mark, in terms of he gave his life for the ransom of the many. And an ox is a very, very powerful animal. It was the heftiest sacrifice, and Jesus Christ laid down his life to save us, to forgive us of our sins, but he also has the power to pull us out of our sins and all of our addictions and know all of our faults and failures and shortcomings. He has the power to transform our lives if we just allow him to do that. So the fact that this temple here, they're going to have sacrifices constantly, animal sacrifices, well, that's going to be portrayed in all the animal sacrifices in regards to the ox. So, and then as far as a man, well, Jesus Christ obviously was a man, and that the eagle is manifested through the cherub, in other words, through the angel, through his heavenly origin, right? So you see it in the angel, and then you see the face of a lion, which points to Jesus Christ as the Lion of Judah. He's king. He's king of the jungle. But all I'm saying is this. When I'm reading this here, well, there's two faces that are missing, but they are incorporated in the cherub itself as far as pointing to the eagle, as far as Christ's heavenly origin, and then it's pointed to the ox in terms of the sacrifices that are going to be offered up on that altar there as a reminder, as a memorial for what Christ did as the suffering servant, as the ox. And then he says this, in verse 20, it says, from the ground to above the entrance, cherubim and palm trees were carved as well as on the wall of the nave. In other words, they're all over the place. They're up. They go right to the ceiling, and they're covered, you know, all over there as far as the palm trees and the images of the cherub. What does it do? It's almost like a constant, continuous reminder of Christ's victory as the God-man. Right? This is what it does. It's just a constant reminder. That's why they're all over the place, to remind us of, you know, Christ is the one that gained the victory for us. Because if it wasn't for him, none of us would be saved. When it says that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Well, it was God who took the initiative to save man. But if it wasn't for Jesus Christ, none of us would be saved. Because it says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish. Now, when it says should not perish, it means should not go to hell, right? But have everlasting life. So when you go into this temple area and you see all these carved images of the cherub and of the palm trees, it really speaks of Christ's victory as the God-man. Then he says in that verse 21, the doorposts of the nave were square. Usually they're round, but even being square, what would that suggest? Because I'm really, like I said, I'm way, way in, over my head, but I'm just kind of, you know, putting it together the best that I can. If you've got square doorposts, why square? Why not round? Good.
Four directions.
Good, good. What I think what it's really pointing to is north, south, east, and west. This applies to, you know, as far as Christ's victory, it's pointing to all around the globe. Because I don't know if you remember, we went through the tabernacle and everything that had to be, that was involved there. There was the altar of incense. It was square, but it had four horns on it. They also had the brazen altar. It was square, and it had four horns on it. The horns pointed to the power to save and the power of prayer. All around the globe, north, south, east, and west. So when I'm looking at these doorposts here, I believe it has some kind of significance to it, because God wouldn't put it there if it didn't. It says the doorposts of the nave were square. As for the front of the sanctuary, the appearance of the doorpost was like that of the other. The altar was wood, 3 cubits high, and its length 2 cubits, and its corner and its base and its sides were of wood. And he said to me, "This is the table that is before the Lord." Now, this is really strange, because it doesn't give you any kind of information other than it's talking about they have an altar. I don't know if you can see that altar there, but it's made of wood, and it's pretty high. It says here, The altar was of wood, 3 cubits high. In other words, about 5 feet, right? That's pretty high for a table. And then he says its length is 2 cubits. That's pretty unusual. A table is usually wider, longer than it is tall, right? Than its height. Well, this here, it talks about this table here, but then it talks about this. He said, "This is the table that is before the Lord." So there's only, I can only speculate here that that probably is pointing to the table of showbread in the tabernacle. That's what that was. It had a table there, and it had the bread on it that they'd change out every Sabbath day. And there were 12 loaves of bread that they would change out. Well, why 12 loaves and why bread? What's that?
12 tribes.
The 12 tribes of Israel, and that God is providing for his people. He just doesn't provide in mass, but he provides individually. All right? And I think that that's what it might be pointing to, because what's kind of significant about this is that there's no mention of the Ark of the Covenant, there's no mention of the lamp, and there's no mention of the altar of incense. Now, I don't know if these things are in there or not. All right, maybe it's just all had its ultimate fulfillment in Jesus Christ, and there's no need for it. But then you wonder, well, why the wooden altar? It's not even overlaid with gold. It's got bread on it. So I think that it just, you know, and my suggestion is that Jesus Christ referred to himself as being the bread that came down from heaven. And the fact that it's not overlaid with gold emphasizes Jesus Christ's humanity, that he is the God-man. But if this wooden altar is not, our table is not overlaid with gold, I think it's really stressing that Jesus Christ is fully man there. But anyway, we're just going to wind this down here, because it says this in verse 23, the nave. Now, the nave is the sanctuary, right? The nave and the sanctuary each had a door, a double door. This is the sanctuary here, and then this is the holy place or the holy of holies there. They got a double door, swinging door, all right, to go in and to go out. And I already mentioned the fact that Jesus Christ referred to himself as being the door. But if you go in and you go out, that's, I think, very, very powerful in terms of a symbolism, because if we are going to be effective as far as our relationship with Christ is concerned, as far as our relationship with the world is concerned, or even our brothers and sisters in the Lord are concerned, we have to go in and spend quiet time alone with God, all alone, touch him in prayer, be touched by him, by his spirit. Then we are in a position to go out. So that's why I think that they mentioned these doors here. They're swinging doors, and there's doors that go into the sanctuary and into the holy place to go in and to go out. Then he says this in that verse 24, each of the doors had two leaves. Two swinging leaves, two leaves for one door and two leaves for the other door. When he's talking about leaves, he's talking about panels going back and forth, swinging back and forth, almost like saloon doors, all right? Probably a bad example, but that's what it looks like, the swinging doors. And like I said, it's to go in and to go out, because that's our relationship with God. We need to go into the presence of God, sit quietly before him, touch him in our spirit, be touched by him with his spirit. Then we're filled, then we're touched by God. Now we're in a position to go out and minister to a lost world, or minister to other people, or minister to the church. I'm telling you, any pastor, minister, priest, evangelist, anybody in the pulpit, if they don't go in and spend time alone with God, all right, and touch him in prayer,
they got no business in the pulpit, because they're just going to be shooting from the hip and saying nothing, because we got to spend that time alone with God in prayer. He says in verse 24, each of the doors had two leaves, two swinging leaves, two leaves for one door and two leaves for the other door. Also, there were carved on them, on the doors of the nave, cherubim and palm trees like those carved on the walls, and there was a threshold of wood on the front of the porch outside. There were latticed windows and palm trees on one side and on the other, and on the sides of the porch. Thus they were the side chambers of the house and the threshold. Like I said, this is really, really tough going. But I'll tell you, what he's talking about here is that not only do you see these carved images all around the walls on the inside of this nave, or the inside of the Holy of Holies, but you see them also on the swinging doors. So it's almost a constant, continuous reminder of heavenly things. Paul tells us in Philippians, whatever's true, whatever's honorable, whatever's good, whatever's excellent, whatever's a good repute or reputation, he says, let your mind dwell upon these things. And when we go into the presence of God, we really have to lift our thoughts to heaven. That's why I think some of these churches, I don't care, Protestant, Catholic, doesn't matter, a lot of them, if you go in there, they have stained glass windows. What's the point of a stained glass window? I'm talking about if you've got images on the stained glass window. What does it do?
It reminds you of whatever the image is.
Right. It lifts your thoughts to heaven. You have an image of maybe Christ or Him crucified, or maybe the apostles, or maybe some figure in the Bible. I don't care. It would be Moses or whatever. When you go into a church and you see all these different pictures, or maybe even statues, or the stained glass windows, what does it do? It elevates our mind to heaven, heavenly things, right? That's the whole purpose of these things here. That's why I do think it's a good thing if you go into a church, and I do have a lot of reminders that can lift our thoughts. You can go to a lot of churches today and there's absolutely nothing on the walls. That's okay too, but I do think if you go into a church and you see a big crucifix on the wall, all right, it's going to do a lot more for you than if you just go into a church and there's nothing at all. No cross, no crucifix, no pictures, no nothing.
Well, the Ten Commandments, there's like no graven images.
Right.
And but stained glass is like, is that some kind of an image?
Oh, no, that's a good question, all right, because what God was saying very clearly there is that He did not want anyone making any kind of image of Him. Right? Whether it be man or beast or reptile or insect or whatever, because that's what all the pagans did, right? So they weren't to make any kind of image. Like, for example, when in Exodus chapter 32, when we read all about how Moses came down off that mountain and they had made a golden calf, where they said this golden calf represented the God of heaven. He represented the God that brought us out from the land of Egypt. Well, that was a total violation of the commandment, thou shalt not make any graven image. But understand this too. When Jesus Christ became a man, guess what? He took on all the attributes of a physical man, and therefore, He also can be portrayed, let's say, in paintings. Now, nobody knows exactly what it looks like. That's a given, right? But once He's done that, then once He became a man, now if artists all throughout the church history have painted pictures of Christ. Now, that's not a graven image, because nobody's bowing down to that statue or that picture. But what that statue or what that picture does is it elevates our thoughts and it helps us focus upon Christ, right? I know it's really helpful for me. If you go into a person's house and you see a picture of their family on the wall, or their son or their daughter or their mother or their father, you wouldn't say, you guys are worshiping idols. Well, that's stupid. All that is a reminder of a person that you love. See, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. And the same thing here, that he's talking about here, being surrounded with images that elevate our thoughts to heaven. It's the old adage, garbage in, garbage out. And the Bible talked about how Solomon says, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he, right? I tell you, just go spend your life viewing pornography. Believe me, your thoughts are not going to be elevated to heaven, all right? And it's going to find expression one way, shape, or form or another, because that's just the way we are. That's why we need to dwell upon things above rather than things that are on earth. And I'm just winding this down right now because it said this in that verse 26, chapter 41 of Ezekiel. There were latticed windows and palm trees on one side and on the other, on the sides of the porch. Thus were the side chambers of the house and the threshold. So, you know what? It would be so cool, in my opinion, if I could have an accurate picture of what exactly this looked like. That's why I have just racked my brain to try and draw my own pictures and then getting everything I get my hands on to try to give you some kind of visual, because the old adage, a picture's worth a thousand words. And then, you know, like I said, in just reading this, it seems like a lot of useless information, but I'm thinking to myself, man, this can't be useless information, because look at the incredible lengths that God has gone through to basically give us all the details as far as this coming temple is concerned and how important it is, right? Because that's where Christ is going to be ruling and reigning ruling the entire world, all right, from this temple. So anyway, let's just go ahead and close with a prayer. Anybody have anyone to add to share?